Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Engine. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Cole Hornaday.
Hey there.
Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
Chris Casso.
Hello.
How is everybody this fine evening?
Just fabulous.
It's doing a little cold. Okay.
It is a wee bit chilly out there. It's been snowing tonight.
It's been snowing for weeks,
yeah,
man. It just won't stop.
And it won't stick either. There have been flurries, but nothing sticky. It's been snowing. Pretty good tonight, but still the roads look pretty clear.
We know these things because we live in the future.
Anyway, let's get to it, friends. Now, I was following a thread about DC putting story titles back on the covers after the whole rebirth thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I read that the barcode will tell you if the cover is a variant and what issue number it is.
It will.
This is true? How do you decipher the barcode?
They'll even tell you what printing you have.
Yep. What printing? Why do you care?
Some people are pretty hardcore about that.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. I actually do care.
I've got a couple here, so I'll try my best to describe what I'm looking at. The barcode has the two blocks, and on the second block, this tiny, smaller block to the right, there's going to be 5 digits. And what you want to do is the first 3 digits are the number of the issue. So, for example, I've got the Infinity Countdown Adam Warlock here because I reviewed it last week, and the first 3 digits say 001. That is correct. It is the first
issue.
If it was like number 675 of the Avengers, your first 3 digits would be 675.
Well, what's going to happen when Action Comics 1000 hits the shelves?
Yeah, I'm actually wondering about that.
Yeah.
The system will blow up.
It's Y2K all over again.
Exactly. So then the next digit, the fourth digit, will be the variant number. Yes. And so, for example, I've got on the Infinity Countdown that says 2. This is the variant edition of it. It's cover B, cover 2, whatever.
Yeah.
So
it's the second cover.
Yep. 0XX number is the issue number. The second, if it's a 1, it's not a variant issue?
It's okay. The normal version. And then the final digit lets you know what printing you have. So this one says 1. This is the first printing.
Mm-hmm.
So as a comparison, I have Dark Knights, The Batman Who Laughs, number 1. This is a reprint. It is the third printing. So it's 001, first issue. 1, because even though it's a reprint, it's only got 1 cover. So it's 1. Okay. And then 3, because it's the third printing.
Yep. Wow.
So you can always tell what printing you have by looking at the last digit at the end of the barcode for all modern single issues. And it's a handy little trick because some people collect all the printings.
Right.
Some people just want the first printing. I don't believe that translates in any way to trade paperbacks.
Well, I'm looking at this Preacher, and it's the first volume of Gone to Texas from an old printing, and it's 001, so it's the first volume, 1, which is the only cover, there's only 1 cover, and then 2, because maybe it's the second printing of Gone to Texas.
It's plausible.
It's plausible.
Yeah.
A lot of times what I see on trade paperbacks is the price point.
Yes.
So if you can't find a price, the last 5 digits will usually tell you. So
4 or 5 digits.
Oh, yeah.
Four digits usually.
So do you have an example there?
I have here Catalyst Prime's Noble, Volume 1. And the last 4 digits on the barcode are 1499. It is a $14.99 trade.
That's the same for this Preacher I have.
So I think,
but not for Cole's version of his Preacher.
Because mine's so old.
So that one might be following the single issue format.
Right. They might have instigated a different system.
And then
maybe
with some trade paperbacks, it will tell you the price.
Cool.
That's kind of the cheats there. Yeah, I'm looking at a Fantagraphics book here called The Hip Hop Family Tree.
With Run DMC on the back. I love it.
Yep. And last 4 digits, $27.99. That is the retail. So trades have that system.
Yeah. And maybe that's just a more modern thing because the Gone to Texas is probably an older, much older printing when they were doing something different. So
it is a very handy cheat. It's one that I almost have never used in the entire time I've worked in a comic book store because I see the invoices this every week. Right. I know what cover it is.
Yeah.
But
this is for those people who want to collect the, you know, a certain print run and they don't have to bother people like you.
Yeah. Well, the nice thing is, so Marvel will usually put down the word second print somewhere, or third print or whatever.
Right.
DC doesn't always. And you would usually have to go to the back small insignia. There's the telephone.
Who's calling at this hour?
And you'd have to look at the small print and it says third printing in the back of this. But as a shortcut, just looking at the barcode, much quicker and easier.
Yeah. Are there any other tips and tricks that the commoner would should know?
Things
to know before you buy, online resources the store uses that is available to other people.
So online resources, this is a selfish desire of mine. Use previewsworld.com/catalog to check out the latest solicitations for things. And then you can also search Previews World for like dates on things when they'll be released or that sort of thing. So if you see something really exciting that was just announced, you can maybe track it through the Previews World. Now, it's not like a like everything that's ever happened, but it is a very good resource. And it is also good to see if you want to know, like I'm constantly looking at when things are coming out for my own personal thing so I can budget and that kind of thing. So I will use that as a resource, and you can look at it anywhere, anytime.
And the nice thing too about that is if you use that resources, the book that you see that you want has a code, usually with a month date in the front.
Yes.
Like for example, SEP, September. And it'll be September 18 and then a five digit code, whatever. If you give that to the retailer instead of just saying, get me thing, we will love you so much more because the code shortens the amount of time we have to search for things.
Right.
Yes.
It means we know exactly what to enter.
And the way that that breaks down is, so for example, this month is February. Anything that's been offered in February is going to start with the code FEB for February. Then it's going to follow with the year, so 18. And then it's going to have a designated four-digit code for the actual item.
Yep.
So it's a very useful tool. It zeroes us, like you said, right into the item that you want. Especially good if you like variants and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
Because that helps tremendously. Let's say we've got A through H on like a one issue.
Yeah.
You know, you give us the code and we immediately go to that F cover that you really wanted.
Just to give you an idea of how much time that saves, I had a customer who consistently just wanted to write down the entirety of what he wanted for every month. And the man wanted quite a lot of things. And so to enter all that data, because he generally would never put the right names or he'd misspell stuff or whatever, it would take me sometimes half an hour to an hour to upload just one order.
Wow.
Once I finally got him to fill out the form with the proper numbers, it took me 5 minutes.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
It's the difference. It makes a big difference.
It really does, especially if you're giving a vague description of the thing that you want and it's really specific what you want. Mm-hmm. We have to figure out, did you misspell something or is it under a different title or is it like a cover A instead of saying it's like the Pantheon variant or something like that? So it really is tremendous for all involved. You get your orders accurately placed.
And it's quicker for you.
And
yeah.
And you just zero right in on it. So.
I totally dig that. I used to work in auto parts and I would sell oil filters to people. And if they came in with the part number of their oil filter, it took a lot of the guesswork out of the game. And I didn't have an angry customer coming back to me saying I sold them the wrong oil filter. And now they can't drive their car back to the store. They had to borrow their wives or whatever.
Yeah.
And they're blaming me because they told me they had an 85 Cadillac instead of a 95 Cadillac. And those are two very different engines.
Uh-huh.
Anyway.
It's the same at like grocery stores. If there's an item that you like that you want to request from your grocery store, having a UPC number, which is the barcode number, is super helpful for people to, because they can zero in on the ordering. It's the same situation.
So get your comics retailer to love you, learn how to find the codes for the books you want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, other than that, there's not too many like technical cheats I could think of, you know. It's just one of those things. The more little bit of research you do goes a long way in helping the entire process.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, speaking of research, I heard that in June of 2013, Rob Liefeld took $35,000 in a Kickstarter to relaunch Brigade, yet no books have shipped.
Actually, I checked on the Kickstarter this afternoon.
Did you?
Because I was just curious, because I really don't like Rob Liefeld, and I'm going to look for any opportunity to like less him, like him even less. And lo and behold, he had updated pictures of the Chromium covers at the printers from like this week.
No way, because I checked the Kickstarter when I wrote this, which was like earlier last week or late last week.
Well, did you go and look at the updates and stuff, or you just look at the nasty
comments? I just saw the top comment, which was like, where's my book, Rob?
Yeah, no, I saw that, and I'm like, okay, well, and it was actually just from like a couple of weeks, maybe just a couple of weeks ago, but still, that's 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. That's like 5 years that he took 35 grand years, from people.
Rumor has it his home was being foreclosed at the time.
Well,
he needed the cash.
Okay. God, I'm sorry. I'm just going to bite my tongue right now.
All right.
Now.
Well, let's try to get that nasty taste out of our mouth.
Thank
and let's
you.
Talk about Kickstarters that have shipped. If there are.
There are. We've supported quite a bit, you know.
So there was one that was a queer sci-fi anthology series. And that one, I think, finished its Kickstarter and shipped pretty close, and we were able to get some of those. There's also been another one called Elements Fire, which was another comic book anthology series with creators of color. That seemed to go off without a hitch. We have a copy of that in the store. Mm-hmm. I think Bingo Love, I think that's shipped. I mean, that also went through Diamond Comics. I think what we're still waiting on for Bingo Love is all the extra material that they got because they extended. They got so much great funding that they're extending it, so we're probably still waiting on some of that stuff.
I think it's always worth mentioning Erica Mowen's Oh Joy sex toy.
Yes.
She's now successfully done 4 of those.
Mm-hmm.
And she has like the perfect model. Her husband, who runs that part of the business, has shared an extensive breakdown on how to put together a successful Kickstarter and where the money goes. So complete transparency. And so that's another case of just like a very successful one that has shipped and has now been picked up by a larger publisher.
Yep.
And you gave one to me last Christmas, Sullivan Sluggers.
Yes.
Oh,
I was
yes.
like, I don't remember giving you Oh Joy sex toy.
I know. I was like, when did we give you Oh Joy sex toy?
I'm changing the title.
Yes,
of the book.
Sullivan Sluggers was initially successful. I did that one personally as well and got a copy, and the store did a bunch. It got ugly afterwards.
Oh, no. Really?
Well, unfortunately, even the print run, it wasn't cut correctly, so there were some problems with the production.
I do have one of those.
You've got one of those, yep.
Yes.
The problem was that I think he didn't estimate the shipping cost enough, so he had to create a secondary Kickstarter to fund shipping out some of the first wave of Kickstarter.
Shipping costs will bite you.
It got really messy, very ugly, to the point where the artist distanced himself and said, I don't want nothing to do with this no more. Don't talk to me anymore. Just burnt him. And so the writer was the one doing the Kickstarter. But there have been many, many, many successful ones. I kickstarted a pair of cute plush magical foxes as a Christmas gift for some friends' daughters. And that was pretty quick, and they came out almost exactly when they said they would.
Yeah.
On the flip side of that, the store has tried funding a lot of things this past year, and the problem is it takes so long, and money out of hand is not a good thing for a retailer.
Right.
So, as a store, we are no longer participating in Kickstarters.
Oh, really? Was that a hard decision you guys made?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like one of the hard ones is, we still haven't received it, even though the soft covers have been released to retailers, is Black by Black Mass Studio.
Yep.
We should have gotten our hardcovers a good long time ago, and they still have not shipped. And they have shipped to some people, so it's like, what's up?
Oh, like you just haven't gotten yours.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I mean, that was a while ago.
Yes, that was a very long time ago.
There was another one by Mandrake and Ostrander. They did a Civil War vampire story. I believe Scott's personal fan of theirs, and he funded so he could get some copies for himself and the store. And it took a long time.
It took a few years, maybe, or something.
I don't think it was years, but I think it was...
It was a while.
Yeah. So we finally got them. Hooray. Yep. We're done, you know.
Yeah.
It's the thing is, like, the trick with Kickstarters and retailing is that we can't necessarily get them back in. Because we're it's not a distribution set system. So it's like, wow, we sold 10 copies of this book within a week. Can't ever get it ever again, in some cases.
Daisy Cutter is an example of that by Kazu Kibuishi. He did a Kickstarter for that, but he had no intention of reprinting them, I think, after that. So we got a good chunk of them, sold them, went to Happy Homes, never seen it again.
Yep.
Yeah.
So
you don't keep something like that for the store for like archives or anything like that? I don't imagine store would.
No,
like,
if you can sell it, you will sell it.
Yeah, we can't afford archives.
The best would be like, you know, give a copy to the library so people could enjoy it forever.
Wow. All right, Kickstarters, man. It's buyer beware when you're funding a Kickstarter.
There are some good things. Like I am seeing a bunch of stuff go from Kickstarter to then getting picked up by a publishing house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like OJ Sex Toy was picked up by an imprint of Oni called Limerous Press. We have seen some other things like that as well. So that's always the best case scenario. Like Bingo Love was picked up by Image. Yeah. Unfortunately, it's not readily available right now, so maybe it'll go back to new printing. But that's always the best case scenario.
It's an amazing way to get noticed as a creator.
Absolutely.
It's great advertising. And if you can operate it and you can take care of fulfillment, fulfillment's one of the biggest parts of that job, then you're good to go. You have people trusting you and waiting for you to do more.
That's right.
But please plan ahead and get your fulfillment figured out. You know?
Yeah, it's really almost like creating your business plan, you know, it's creating a Kickstarter and really having a way to fulfill upon those things.
It's a difference of, are you an artist or are you willing to learn how to be a businessman with your art?
Exactly.
That's the hard part, man.
Oh, yeah.
That's really tough.
I feel bad because I have a friend who put together a Kickstarter for a webcomic he was doing, and he wanted to raise $35,000.
Ooh.
And I don't remember how, he didn't make it, but I don't remember how much money he eventually raised. I think it was probably less than 3,000.
Yeah.
But I'm like, man, you are shooting for the stars.
Yeah, he must have had a very large goal.
I think he wanted to take a year off of work and do it, but power to you if you make it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
That create a Patreon. And that's it's not a Kickstarter at that point. Get somebody to fund your studio or whatever.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, Kickstarters, like I said, it's buyer beware. There's a lot of cool stuff out there. But if you are a creator of a Kickstarter and you want to promote your stuff, send me a link. And if we like it, we might talk about it. Let's move on to book report, everybody. And this is a very special 4-part book report. We all read the same thing, thanks to Nicole, who proposed this idea. Nicole, tell us what we're reading.
We are reading Preacher by Garth Ennis and Steve Dillon. And this came out of Cole and I just by the by saying we wanted to reread Preacher at some point, and so this is me following up on it and forcing everybody to read it.
Yeah.
So, and thanks to Cole's deteriorating memory loop, my recollection from the core of this discussion from many, many months ago was that it was going to hinge around maybe even doing comparison contrast between the original Vertigo comic series and the AMC TV series. I discovered this afternoon that I made all that up. So, and as a matter of fact, no one at this table has watched a season of Preacher in its entirety save myself.
I saw an episode.
So I've seen
most of an episode.
I've seen both seasons, so I can speak to that. But
I've seen nothing.
So it's very strange that that's what the story that I made up that followed.
maybe it was just like, there's no reason to reread this, right? It must be tied into the TV show or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, it's been maybe 10 years since I've read Preacher. I mean, it's been a long time.
Maybe we were talking about
the TV series coming out, and
we looked at each other and said, yeah, we should reread that.
Yeah.
And that's how, just off the top, I have not read these since I originally got my hands on the paperback trades, and I've got some pretty old trades.
They are yellow.
When did they come out? Like, I'm looking for a year on the back of this printing that
I have.
The
original series came out.
Was it early 2000s?
No.
There is a shot
of
the World Trade Center in here, and I thought that might have been a curious inclusion if it were after that.
This was one of the first blockbuster Vertigo series. And I say that because I used to deal comics and collectibles, you know, sifted from thrift stores in my own personal collection at these little hole-in-the-wall shows at, like, you know, the VA Hall and whatnot in Madison, Wisconsin. And one afternoon, this young man came in with just a box of comics. Most of them were the first not even year of Preacher. He put $25 to $50 on each of them and sold them all within a half hour, got up and left, cleared out his table and left, because that's how popular the series was when it started. People were scrambling. Now we see this pretty frequently, but when this series came out, it was blowing people's minds. We didn't have this type of Tarantino style action storytelling much in comics. Now I'm sad to say it's kind of the stock and trade for a lot of adult style comics, but and I avoided it because I watched this guy make so much money, and so many people that I didn't want to spend any kind of quality time with walking by and drooling over his comic books and then chilling out. Like, just watch this guy drop a $100 bill on the table to buy two comic books, or maybe even one. I was like, no, no, buy my garbage. I got to pay rent.
Jeez.
Anyway.
I'll say this for, I don't know if it's Garth Ennis or Steve Dillon. He likes shooting people in the face.
He
likes
shooting
people in the face.
This is like goodness.
Uber, uber violent series.
Mm-hmm. So who would like to give a synopsis of the general gist of this comic book?
I could try. It is a modern supernatural Western drama.
You going to start with Hellblazer?
Sounds good. Yeah. Sounds good.
With Hellblazer?
Mm-hmm. You going to start with Hellblazer? With Genesis?
You don't need to. That's a trick.
Okay. Just
I know it's there.
A stickler there.
Oh, that's okay. So it follows Jesse Custer, who is a down on his luck is kind of an understatement. he is a preacher in a small town, and he hates life. He hates everything. He gets drunk, and he spills the secrets of the town.
Yep.
And he
is fallen from grace in a major way. Yeah.
And there's a side story that forms at the same time that basically there's this young girl named Tulip who is going to go kill somebody with a gun, and she meets this Irish guy who is up to no good as well. And
everybody's up to no good.
Yep. And the preacher is giving a sermon, and the whole town is there because he made a fool of himself the night before. And something bursts through the doors in the fiery cataclysm and blows up the entire town and possesses him.
Yep.
And
Jesse is the only survivor in the, in the whole church. Yep.
And, but nobody knows that.
And everybody in the town is in the church. Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of forms around that mystery of what happened.
Yep.
And I don't feel like I feel like I'm dancing around like there's spoilers, but this has been out long enough we could just spill it out.
I preacher spoilers. And I'll put that in the show
notes. In fact, I'd prefer if everyone would just read along with us and enjoy this.
All right, Preacher Book Club. Get your hats on.
That's
book hats
right.
on.
But so the Tulip and Cassidy see the giant mushroom cloud from the distance. They go to investigate. Turns out that Tulip and Jesse knew each other from the past.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that he is possessed by something called Genesis, which is the child of an angel and a demon.
Yep.
And it gives him the word of God, the ability to tell people to do anything and they have to.
Mm-hmm.
Much and, like the purple man.
Mm-hmm.
And heaven is
immediately where I went.
All in a tizzy because this was not supposed to, you know,
ever happen.
It's an abomination. Genesis is off on the run, and they're freaking out.
And Genesis is so powerful that once it's kind of disappears, God just disappears.
Yep.
God goes on vacation.
God is like, oops. bye, guys.
And the angels in charge release the Saint of Killers, who is a very mean cowboy. That
He's
is John the angel
Wayne.
Of death.
Yeah.
No, John Wayne is John Wayne.
No, I know, but the Saint of Killers is also like a John Wayne.
It's a John Wayne aspect. I had confused
He's an
the
archetype.
Two at first.
Right.
Yeah. Yes.
Did you really?
I did, because you never see John Wayne's face when he's talking to Jesse.
Don't.
So I'm like, is this the same dude?
Because copyright.
See, in my brain, I never made that connection point because John Wayne's always been kind of a not port. shortly in my mind. But even here, when you see him, just for clarification, Jesse Custer is often visited by the spirit, ghost, figment of his imagination, John Wayne.
Right. Yes.
And he's always looking a little fat from behind. Mm-hmm. I never pictured the Saint of Killers in any way the same light. He's just this horrible, horrible killing machine.
You know, death eye, death stare. And his skin is deathly blue.
He has more of a Clint Eastwood feel to me at certain times.
Good.
It's a melding to me. Yeah. That's how it's always hit.
And Revelation, Cassidy is a vampire, but he only eats bad people or whoever pisses him off.
It's the Dexter of vampires.
Yes.
And you get a colorful cast, including Arsface and the very racist cop that is his father.
Yep.
And a lot of other people. So
there's a really amazing surrounding cast throughout the series. A lot of interesting side stories, great character development.
It's really engaging. I read it for the first time just last week, and I read the whole book, series one and two, in just two sittings. That was really I was really engaged in it.
There was an old review, I think, from Wizard Magazine that it was actually one of the best reviews of the book, which is it just said, if you removed all the art and just kept the word balloons, you'd know exactly who was talking at any given point without a clarification. Because he does that thing where every voice has a distinct way of talking. Mm-hmm. And Cassidy, you know instantly it's Cassidy.
He's an Irish man, but it's not one of those things. I've read some of Garth Ennis's stuff, like his Dick series.
Oh, yeah.
And it's really hard to read. Because it's in that dialect of like two Irish guys with like really heavy brogues.
Yeah, this is clear.
And Cassidy is one of my favorite characters. Mm-hmm. And
a minor thing worth noting is that each one of us has read a different version.
Yeah.
Yes.
So Cole has what I'm guessing is a second printing. Mm-hmm. Nicole has the modern hardcover.
Which collects like two volumes. Of something like that.
Ben has one of the last printing soft covers.
But point of clarification, I didn't actually read this version. I read the version that Nicole has loaned that to me, even though this was sitting on my bookshelf the entire time.
And then I have the Absolute Preacher, which is a giant weapon that I kill people with.
It's oversized really big,
and really big. Yeah.
So these different collections have different content, which caused me tremendous confusion because mine goes from issue 1 to 7, and we didn't all read the same quantity of issues, right?
We all read the first story arc.
I've read the first two because it's what was in that book.
Yeah,
so,
okay.
But this goes to, they're driving off into the sunset.
Yeah.
And we have the really sad end of the cop with the worst luck in the world.
Mm-hmm. Which is another side story with another bunch of characters tie in.
But that was interesting because that side story has narration. You don't get narration.
Not too often throughout
the
series.
Like with the main story.
Yeah. I was going somewhere
we've all read different.
It speaks to how popular the series is that they keep reprinting it in all these different formats.
That's right.
Yes, that's where I was going. Go ahead.
It's an epic bloodbath.
Yep.
It's epic Garth Ennis, and really speaks to his capacity as a storyteller, his ability to build characters, but also his absolute expansive disdain for humanity.
Which is part of why I love Preacher.
Which is part of the charm, but also one of the reasons why it was actually why I avoided reading it for so long. And I picked up I think I avoided reading it for 10 years, and I picked up a used copy of one of the trades and read it, and I'm like, oh man, I actually kind of like this. You know, and then proceeded to pick up all the trades after that. I watched the first two seasons of the show and was a little bit perturbed by the amendments they made. I mean, the tone is still there. There's no mistaking that. I think some of the casting is quite good, but they do play fast and loose with the story to sort of like expand it, which seems kind of silly to me because it's a pretty long story and we have a bit of a road ahead of us, you know, in our little project here because it covers a lot of ground.
Were you going to add something to what he's... Before
no,
the TV
question.
Show?
So continue the TV show talk. I'm going to go somewhere else after that.
Okay.
So The cast of the TV series is really quite good, but they expand the first season. What is the where are they? What is the town that we start at?
Anvil?
Yeah. Yes. Is it Anvil? Is that what you said? No, I can't remember. What?
Anvil.
Anvil.
A-N-N-V-I-L.
Okay, I don't remember.
Is that it?
I don't know.
I might be wrong, but that's the name that sticks in my mind.
So we spend the whole first season actually in that
Anvil.
Town.
Yes!
Good job.
Ben wins.
I don't know if that's the name of the town in the TV series.
Oh, okay.
But we spend the whole first season there, and we don't actually get... I mean, Jesse gets merges with Genesis early on, but we don't, like, destroy the church and the town.
And then you're not, out of there and to the next thing.
That's the climax of the first season. So we meet Tulip, and we meet...
Cassidy
early on. Tulip is a denizen of this town, and she and Jesse not only grew up together but became hit people together. Like, you know, they work for a secret shop where they go out and kill people. And, you know, he was called back to his hometown to preach when his his father had laid that responsibility on him as a little boy. And I think that's in the comic book as well.
And the thing to note is that Tulip is, like, trying to be a hit person, but is not very good at it. And she's kind of nervous and squirrely a little bit.
In the TV
series. And in the TV show, it sounds like she's well-versed.
Yeah, no, she is a
seasoned. Killing people.
She's got this Cadillac. She's got an arsenal on her own. She is a seasoned, confident hit person and answers to no one.
Yeah.
The character that I think is most consistent is Cassidy. In fact, when I was reading the graphic novel, I heard the actor Joseph Gilgan's voice as I was reading it, because I think he was one of the best casting between that character.
I immediately looked up the first episode of the first season of Preacher after I had finished reading it, because I'm like, I want to see how they serialize this. And I was immediately turned off because, like, Seth Rogen was, like, an executive producer.
Yeah, that was my big concern right after that.
I think they were...
Because Green Hornet.
The flavor felt okay. Oddly enough, I didn't care about the casting choice of Tulip, but I did not like... the actor who played Jesse, and it's only because I don't think he looked enough like him. And when I was watching the show, I'm doing that dumb fanboy thing where when they would get something wrong, I'd go, no, and I couldn't make it through the entire episode.
And it's been so long since I read the series as a whole that I was kind of going, okay, I don't think this is right, but the tone was okay. And, you know, sometimes that's the allowance you give adaptations, is like, does it capture the tone? Does it capture the feel?
Right. I still wanted the casting people to find somebody with a Steve Dillon like mug.
Of course. Yeah.
You know, because everybody's got these strong jaws and these big noses. Yeah.
But we, like, for example, the Arseface character, he becomes a principal character in the story.
Yeah.
In the series. And we learn all about his backstory. And
again, people shooting, getting shot in the face.
And then we have, and now there was a 4-part miniseries telling the backstory of the Saint of Killers. And when we get to the second season, they devote probably the same, if you can do that kind of comparison, probably the same amount of time in the TV series as they did with the 4-part miniseries. That I think they do give you his entire background, the death of his family, why he became so vicious and vindictive, and that sort of thing. But they take what I appreciate is that they take a lot of time to develop all of these characters, and probably even maybe going a step further. Now, the second season was super problematic. I'm just going to tell one thing about it that I am having a hard time with, and it may stop me from watching the series going forward. And that is that at one point, Jesse turns to Arseface. What's the kid's real name? Do you guys know?
Eugene.
Turns to Eugene and says, because Eugene is actually coming to him for help, and I think Jesse's hungover or something. He just turns to Eugene and says, Eugene, go to hell. And he does, and he disappears, and he wakes up in hell.
Oh, he did it with the Word of God?
Yes. Yeah, he does a lot of bad things with the Word of God. So Jesse's in hell, and it looks like a prison, and there are certain conceits of what this hell is like, but the first person who befriends Jesse is Adolf Hitler.
Eugene.
Eugene.
Excuse me.
I was wondering. I was like, I thought he told Eugene to go to hell. Okay.
I'm sorry.
No. So Eugene.
I'm getting really tired.
It's okay. It's okay.
Eugene.
Hitler befriends him while all the other thugs in this hell prison are bullying Eugene. You know, here comes old Adolf, and you know,
kind of coming to the rescue.
Comes to the rescue, tells him his story, and ultimately Eugene helps Adolf escape from hell and back to the modern world. So, and this is all on the heels of the election, of the white supremacist crap we're dealing with right now, the white nationalism. And I'm kind of looking at this whole scenario that's being played out, going, "This is really, really in bad taste, and I don't like it." And you know, maybe if you tried to tell a story back in the 80s or the 70s where, hey, let's experiment with Hitler being, you know, a misunderstood guy.
I'm going to bet you money that he's manipulating Eugene and they're going to kill him in the most horrible way.
That's great. I'm looking forward to that. But right now, they devote a lot of time to making him sympathetic. Mm-hmm. So, anyway.
I think you're probably right. That sounds like a more logical.
But he's been released into the world. He's here in the modern world, you know, befuddled by modern traffic and technology and all that kind of cute
stuff. Man, what must that be like as an actor to play a sympathetic Hitler? The only thing I think that might bring me back to watching the TV show, and this is last thing I'll say about the TV show, is that W. Earl Brown plays Sheriff Root, Eugene's dad, who's a completely different character in the TV show than he is in the book.
Yeah,
and he's
it's a difficult character.
But he's actually a really great actor. He's from Deadwood. Mm-hmm. He's Al Swearengen's right hand man in Deadwood. And I really enjoyed him. But I'm like, oh, yay, W. Earl Brown is in the... Oh, he's that guy?
Yeah, and that guy in the comic throws the N-word around like nothing. He's very racist.
Yeah.
And that he does meet a very bad end, so...
But he's just like a bumbling cop in this one.
So. Yeah, it's something to note. One of Garth Ennis' staple is to consistently throw in the most racist, horrible people, but the most horrible things will happen to them. And there will usually be some sort of discussion about why is it that the saviors of the white race are always the worst examples of it. Quick question. How old were you when you read Preacher the first time? Rough estimate.
Mid-30s?
How old do you think you were, Nicole?
Probably mid-20s.
Mid-20s, and how old?
41.
41, yes. Again, we have a great range of different things happening.
Because Chris was how old?
13.
That's right.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, there's a great story to that.
Yeah.
Did you get in trouble?
No.
No.
No. No.
Did you shoot somebody in the face?
It's even better. Yeah. Just wait for it.
No, this is when, so my mom would take me to go buy comics, and she never really tried to, you know, control what I was getting or anything, you know. But so the one time I had a pile, and I grabbed Preacher number one, and I grabbed a couple other things, and she looked at the pile, and the one book she said no to was Morbius, the Living Vampire, because there was a scantily clad lady death-like character on the cover on top of a mountain of skulls, and she's like, gonna do some parenting on that one. No. And it's just like, this one made it right through, because the initial cover is a very, you know, it's just a guy in front of a burning church. And
why should that be cause for concern?
So 13, and here I am today.
13.
Garth Ennis is a formative part of my childhood.
The one thing that I left out about the TV series is that a lot of the first season is devoted to a character who doesn't exist in the comic. And that's Jackie. Is it Jackie Earle Haley? Played Rorschach in Watchmen. And, so he is this very Ennis-like character who runs this livestock empire and runs the whole town.
Oh.
And he's got everybody in his pocket.
He is in the books. Yeah.
Is he?
Yeah. The crazy guy with the weird glasses that likes to have relations with meat. I'm pretty sure that's supposed to be the same character.
It sounds like. Yeah. But I mean,
they
devote a lot.
No.
Does that he come later?
Way later.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. Great. Later.
Okay. I can't remember anything. That's why I'm rereading Preacher. That's like it's been too long.
There's a whole subplot about Jesse becoming like the sheriff of a town, and there's the guy who runs the town, and he's the meat man. And I noticed that name in the pilot episode. I'm like, oh, we're jumping to him right now,
because
he's like not until like 5-6 story arcs later.
Cool. I'm glad you remember that, because I did not.
I said this was going to be the last thing I would say about the TV show. It's not. I just thought of something else.
Okay.
K Cassidy in the comic has like sometimes finds himself in some real like sticky situations. And yes. One of my favorite things he did was he was trapped in the house of I think I'm skipping books too. I think this is the second.
I know where you're going.
He finds himself locked in the house in daytime, locked in this house of like the serial killer, yeah. And the cops are surrounding the house and they think he's the serial killer. Yep. So to get out of it, he stabs himself in the throat and gets taken out in a body bag. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the TV show, he's a badass martial artist fighter, you know. And so I'm like, Cassidy is more of like the cool
sneaky punk.
Yeah.
He's part, scrappy brawler, part I will rip your throat out kind of vampire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But martial artist?
Yeah. I don't know about that.
Martial artist, but there's a really boss fight scene that introduces his...
The very first pilot, is him in the plane fighting, Templars to death swords, and, it's a very hardcore fight scene.
It's actually pretty cool, but
it's really cool.
Again, it's that's not that character.
Yeah.
They're the fellas from the... Oh, who's the... Now I can't remember.
The Grail?
The Grail. They're Grail peoples.
Yeah.
What's his butt from the Grail... comes in to the second season, and there's actually a couple of really cool sequences with that. So I'm actually enjoying the TV series. I have those quibbles with the Hitler character, and sometimes I feel like expanding on characters feels really for a TV series versus the original print version is really contrived, to pad it. And there are times where I did feel like it was getting padded out, but
So in everybody's rereading, did anybody take anything different this time or anything new?
I think it just reignited that I still really love this series. I was afraid that there's been some stuff that my tastes have changed over years. So there was some stuff that I have grown out of, and I was afraid that maybe Preacher might be one of them, even though I had a fondness for it. And I just found that it was still really good, and I can't wait to reread the rest of the series. Mm-hmm. I think that I had in mind what might be a turnoff for people, just because it's kind of good to know that, and to be refreshed on it. And I mean, Jesse and Cassidy totally have a bro relationship.
Yeah.
And, Jesse said some callous things about Tulip, and I was like, oh, I don't remember that being that way. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of violence, and it's very crass, but I already knew that.
Yeah, so you know who they recommended to and not
exactly,
to.
Exactly, just a little refresher on it. But I've just found that it still held up for me, and I wasn't necessarily expecting that.
Mm-hmm. How many volumes are there?
The current format are chunky editions, and there are six of those. They're called books instead of trade paperbacks.
Do they each contain two?
What you
story
read,
arcs?
My hardcover, is what is the current formatting, just in softcover.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's how they are now.
All right.
To answer your question, I really enjoyed reading it again because I pretty much forgot 95% of it, and I was also watching it after I'd watched the TV series, so that was interesting. I think the most problematic distinction is the take on Tulip in the TV series and the take on Tulip in the book. And I know because I think that Tulip is I see the concern that she's really subordinate to the other two male characters, and they just want the radical opposite direction of that.
Super radical.
Yeah. I mean, I could see this somewhat subordinate, but she does pipe up, and I feel like she does hold her own, which is what I've always appreciated about Tulip.
And they make it a point to later on that she will not put up with any crap.
Absolutely. Yeah. So if you read this first one and be like, she's kind of just going along with stuff. Just wait. Yeah.
So I don't, like I said, I don't remember a lot.
Yeah.
Of it,
and especially in stark contrast to the TV show, I'm sure.
Yeah.
What about you, Chris? Oh, sorry.
No.
Mm-hmm. No. So I've basically have read this on average almost once per year. So you don't get too much more each time. But on this time, I would like to very much point out that Matt Hollingsworth, that's the colors. Clem Robbins, the letterer, The lettering is almost its own character throughout the series. Mm-hmm. It's not something you notice on any initial reads, but it is a very unique font used throughout the series, and the way that it controls the story in certain ways is fantastic. So everybody is important in the creation of a comic book, but yes. On this, my like 8 billionth reading, Clem Robbins is the old star. So
I don't know if you said this before we recorded, but you had said that somebody had written about Preacher and said that if you took all the characters out and mm-hmm. just read the word bubbles.
Yes.
I don't know if we said that on recording.
Yeah, we did. Yep.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
We had pre-conversations and during conversations, yes. And now it's post-conversation.
All right. Speaking of post-conversations, do we have any final words on Preacher?
I am thoroughly enjoying rereading it. I'm looking forward to doing this some more.
Indeed.
I was surprised. Because, you know, as I've gotten older, I've gotten less patient with gratuitous violence. But I was like, we've had lengthy conversations about when it's justified and when it suits the story. And, man, it still suits this story for me. So
yeah, I was definitely anxious to get my hardcover back. I was like, my preciouses, come back home.
Like I had it for a whole 5 weeks.
I know, too long.
I ain't giving none of you my hardcover.
Nope.
All right, well, it's too heavy. With that, that's our first special Preacher book report. Look for us reviewing the next 6 issues coming soon or later, whenever that's going to be. In the meantime, that is our show. Coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com, as well as Comics Dungeon here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes or however you get your podcasts at perfectboundpodcast.com. We're also on TuneIn. Check us out there. And you send us an email at perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. Now, friends, get your quiz hats on. It's quiz time. And this week, our questions come to us from Mr. Cole Hornaday. Lay it on us, Cole.
Okay, so thanks to having recently binged on Sci-Fi Channel's TV adaptation of Grant Morrison and Derek Robertson's black humor bloodbath, Happy, I have been inspired to share with you the following quiz time. Now, have you guys read Happy?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Read the first issue of it.
Okay, so it's about, in case folks don't know, it's the story of a corrupt, intoxicated ex-cop turned hitman who encounters a tiny blue flying horse named Happy that may or may not be a fantasy delusion brought on by gunshot trauma, drugs, and blood loss. And Happy tries to convince this our lead character to help him find his daughter that he knew nothing about that's been abducted by an evil Santa Claus. It's twisted. So I'm like 6 episodes in. I think there are 10 Sci-Fi Channel series stars. Christopher Maloney from Special Victims Unit, and the voice of Patton Oswalt is Happy, which actually makes the freaking show for me. Anyway, here we go. This quiz time is entitled It Was Just My Imagination, a quiz time devoted to famous and infamous imaginary friends.
All right.
First, based on the stage play of the same name, this film about a 6-foot-tall invisible rabbit was immortalized thanks to the impeccable performance of Jimmy Stewart. Please name this particular pooka. Sir.
Harvey.
Harvey was originally written for the stage in 1944. It was adapted to film in 1950 and directed by Henry Koster. There have been so many adaptations of Harvey, it's frightening. Like, they've adapted it for television like once every year.
Fun fact about Harvey, the movie starring Jimmy Stewart. Harvey was a 6-foot rabbit. Jimmy Stewart was 6'2", but always looked up to Harvey.
Oh, that's wrong. That's so wrong. Well, speaking of bunnies, this uber creepy metal faced rabbit named Frank haunts Jake Gyllenhaal in this mind bending cult film from 2001. What's the movie?
Donnie Darko.
Donnie Darko, released in 2001, written and directed by Richard Kelly. I need to go back and rewatch that movie because it blew my brain open the first time I saw it, and I fell in love with the theme song.
It's got a great score.
And I need to go back. And I also have a Frank action figure.
Yes.
Of course.
Yes.
Of course I do. This imaginary stuffed tiger come to life was one half of a world-famous comic strip duo who daily entertained the world from 1985 to 1997. Who is that?
Hobbs
of Calvin Hobbes, created by Bill Watterson. I didn't realize we've talked about the strip, but I didn't realize it ran for that long.
Oh, nearly long enough.
Not nearly long enough. Oh, the friends you meet on Sesame Street. Viewers were never certain if the furry pachyderm-like creature was a real-life figment of Big Bird's imagination or both. But hey, they were both Muppets, so Who are we talking about?
Snuffleupagus.
Mr. Snuffleupagus.
Mr. Aloysius Snuffleupagus, more commonly known as Mr. Snuffleupagus or Snuffleupagus or Snuffy for short.
Hey, bird.
Did you get a little, like, giggle when you were typing that out?
Of course.
Yeah, of course. Did. Of course.
Snuffy first appeared on Sesame Street November 8th, 1971. Wow. And, you know, I remember being so much older when he first appeared, and I was not.
Snuffy sounds like a different kind of Garth Ennis character.
That's oh my true. God.
Lastly, in this eponymous black comedy starring Phoebe Cates, who struggles to reconcile the destruction of her imploded personal life and professional life with the help of her cruel and obnoxious imaginary childhood friend who spreads havoc wherever they go. Name that film and that friend of the same name.
Fred.
Drop Dead Fred.
Was
I was
going
to write Dead Fred.
I was, yeah.
That's the band.
Yes. I was there too.
Too sexy for my. Drop Dead Fred was released in 1991, directed by Ate DeJong. Fred played by the late Rick Mayall, known for his comedic work in The Young Ones.
Late?
He died in 2012 of a heart attack.
Mm. Yeah. All right, well, thank you, Cole.
You're welcome.
And thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.
Doop.